want to apologize for keeping you, but I was, it's my fault, I was delayed at a meeting that occurred during the lunch hour. We now call the last case scheduled for today, which is 11-AP-1176 and 11-AP-1177. McLeod versus Mudlap and Mudlap versus McLeod. And we will first hear from Gregory, is it Mager? Mager, representing Patricia Mudlap, Barbara Nye, and Lila Laubenheimer. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Gregory Mager. I represent Patricia Mudloff, Barbara Nye, and Millard Laubenheimer. The issue in this case is whether a court in the state of Wisconsin has the authority to posthumously invalidate a marriage. It has been the law in Wisconsin for more than 125 years that courts do have this power. That goes back to the Williams case of 1885. This principle has been repeated in case law since the Williams case in a case that I am going to mispronounce. Hopefully I'll get it right. Lyons, repeated in Davidson in 1967 and applied most recently in the estate of Toutant in 2001. Toutant is the key to understanding how this principle is applied in this respect. The authority for a court to posthumously invalidate a marriage does not lie in Chapter 767. Chapter 767 is actions affecting the family. The authority as set forth in Toutant is the declaratory judgment power of a court relying on the Chapter 765, specifically 765.03 and 765.04. Now, there has been a question or an argument that the modification or recodification of Chapter 767 a number of years ago, eliminating the word void from the annulment statute, has somehow eliminated court's power to void marriages. Specifically, the argument is that annulment is the only way to void a marriage, and that simply is not the case anymore. That never was the case. Courts have always had that authority. The authority did not come from Chapter 767, and it did not come from the annulment statute. And it is true that annulment by statute can only occur when both parties are alive. That is not true in the case of voiding a marriage. And again, we have case law going back to 1885 stating so. And in fact, again, getting back to Toutant, Toutant makes it clear this argument, which was addressed in Toutant, is not the correct argument. Nobody is asking for an annulment of this marriage. An annulment is not possible. We understand that. What we're asking, what we were asking the probate court to do, is to void the marriage. And the basis for voiding the marriage is that it is our position that Nancy Laubenheimer was not competent at the time that the marriage took place.
Well, what's the difference between voiding a marriage and an annulment?
Justice, the difference is that voiding a marriage has to do with, I guess, a sliding scale. You have those marriages that are absolutely void from their very beginning, and those can be voided and should be voided when those situations cannot be corrected or the marriage cannot be subsequently ratified. Then you have a spectrum of marriages where you go from void and could never be fixed, so to speak, all the way to those which, under certain circumstances, can be made valid. For example, one of the more common examples is where an individual is divorced, is not supposed to remarry within 6 months of that date of divorce, but then does subsequently marry, and the parties continue to live together as married folks beyond that six-month impediment. And that then creates a marriage that is void initially, becomes voidable. And as folks continue to conduct themselves in a way that would indicate that the conditions that would make it void can be subsequently corrected, I think that under those circumstances, that would be where then you shift from voiding to potentially an annulment. Now, there is another difference, I think, that I'm not sure is explicitly stated anywhere, other than by piecing together what different cases and statutes have said. Clearly, an annulment is only available when both parties to the marriage remain alive. The statute makes it clear. If one of the parties has passed away, you cannot have an annulment. When one of the parties passes away, though, and the conditions that needed to be met for this, for a marriage to be a valid marriage, I think the remedy for that situation is voiding the marriage. And again, I think the difference becomes, can there be, whatever the impediment to it being a valid marriage, can that be cured? In this particular case, because the individual has passed away, her mental condition is unfortunately not going to get any better. This is different than a situation, as I said, where an individual got married before the expiration of the six-month waiting period after the granting of a divorce.
If someone got married within the six-month period of time that you're not supposed to remarry, I understand how that's pretty clear. Here was your date of divorce. Here was the date you were married. That is a void period of time, right? But when you have something like someone's mental state or capacity, and those are things that in probate court and in, you know, guardianships and different proceedings are debated up and down, left and right, and doctors debate. How as a matter of law, is a judge supposed to decide that this particular marriage should be void? Declared void when one person is deceased. Well, it'd be hard enough if you had the person still alive right now, you know, to take that back to what their mental state might have been on the date, on the moment, on the minute that they got married. But help me out with this.
Well, there are two issues in the question. The first one is, what does the law provide in terms of a court's authority? And again, I think the law is clear here. In Wisconsin, the court has the authority to make that determination. Then the second part is, how do you go about proving that? And under the circumstances of this case, that's where the case stopped for us, because we never got to that point. Now, Judge Gonring did express some concerns about, well, okay, if his decision was not correct, he had asked for some guidance as to how to go about doing that. But I don't know that that is particularly – I don't know that that is any more difficult than any other case where a judge has to make a finding of fact based on the evidence provided, because there are lots of cases where the evidence is very close or it's complicated or it's difficult. And judges handle those situations every day.
Well, yeah, I understand that. I did that for a decade, so I've got that. But what – I don't understand is, I mean, I could understand perhaps someone evaluating her mental state now. I'm trying to figure out how you would prove this. Evaluating her mental state now and saying, okay, based upon the deterioration of the brain and this kind of particular diagnosis at this particular date and time, there's no possible way. I mean, but this person is deceased now. So what would you rely on? You would rely on the doctor order and that's it?
Well, we have a number of different ways of going about proving this. Number one, we have the two medical doctors who were not attached to anybody. She went to the hospital. They treated her, and they executed statements of incapacity which invoked her health care power of attorney. That's number one. Number two, her personal physician, who the probate court felt had been selected by the stepchildren, but in fact was her personal physician, had already indicated prior to her death that she did not have the capacity to make this decision. In addition, Judge Farragher, in a guardianship proceeding, had granted temporary guardianship and did not grant...
the right to marriage?
No, because he specifically said, I'm not going to do that until we get to the permanent.
Right.
Unfortunately, she passed away first.
So that's my point. There is a whole, if I recall the form correctly, a whole checklist of different rights people can and cannot retain. And they vary greatly, and it depends on the person, and it depends where they are on the spectrum of their particular mental health situation. And so there's no court document. There's a couple of doctors' opinions. But, I mean, all the time in guardianship proceedings, you have one doctor say, oh, gosh, this person is incapable. Another doctor may say this person is capable or they can retain these certain rights. And the only thing in place at this point was a guardianship order that still allowed her the right to marry?
It was actually a temporary guardianship order, and I don't think it addressed whether she had the right to marry. I do know that the right to commence an annulment was not granted specifically because Judge Farragher said this is a temporary order at this point. And before the permanent guardianship proceedings could begin, she passed away.
Okay.
And
you answered the difference between void and annulment is that void is right from the beginning. An annulment might be correctable. And if I understood your briefs, void from beginning would be lack of competence to enter a marriage.
That would be one of the circumstances, yes.
And, for example, that which could be correctable is an order that you can't remarry after a divorce for 6 months. So you might be able to annul within the first 6 months, but that it would be in effect corrected if a marriage lasted more than 6 months, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last
part.
Well,
if the marriage lasted more than 6 months after the divorce, it corrected itself.
I think that's where it shifts to being a voidable marriage, and then I think a judge has to make the determination at that point. I don't think it automatically becomes a valid marriage, and I think that's where these fights begin in the family court, where individuals start to ask that their marriage be declared void, and then the divorce court has to get into the question of void versus voidable.
Okay, well, in this particular example, the issue is whether it was void at the very beginning because of lack of competence on the woman's part, right? So let us suppose she has survived and the family brought annulment action. Should they have brought an annulment action because it's not correctable?
I don't know under those circumstances whether the family would have the right to bring an annulment action independent of there being a guardianship over her.
All right. We've got a temporary guardianship over her. The various powers of the guardian, which are quite lengthy, and the permanent guardianship haven't been decided. And so the guardian brings an annulment action. Should the guardian bring an annulment action, or should the guardian bring a declaratory judgment action, or should the guardian bring some other kind of action?
I think if the two parties remain alive, I think you bring an annulment.
So annulment deals with more than what's correctable.
I agree. I think that annulment is when both parties remain alive. I think once a party dies and the conditions are set, meaning they cannot be corrected, I think then you have the action in the probate court to void the marriage.
Why don't you just which the other side takes the position, hey, we got a statute. It says you can annul, which means you're going to make it void, right? But it says court has jurisdiction, or if you prefer the word competence, I don't want to get confused between the court's competence and her competence. The court has competence only when the parties are alive. Therefore, you're out of luck. What's the matter with that argument? I mean, that is their argument, isn't it?
Their argument is definitely that now that she has passed away, there's not the ability to bring an annulment, and annulment is the only remedy.
That's right. So what's the matter with that argument?
Well, the first thing that's the matter with that argument is that that's not the current state of the law in Wisconsin and hasn't been for more than 125 years. Now, that argument also ties into it this recodification of Chapter 767, where the word void was removed from the annulment statute. And again, the cases that lead up to this recodification of Chapter 767, including Tutant, and Tutant being the one that makes it most explicitly clear, the authority comes from Chapter 765. So either Tutant was wrong, Davidson was wrong, Leanne's was wrong, Williams was wrong, going back to 1885, that these are actions that can be maintained. Or that has been the law, and with Tutant making explicit where that authority comes from, that means that their argument that this recodification of Chapter 767 somehow impacts Chapter 765, that's the problem. The cases are clear going back to 1885. There is authority to do this. I don't think that a change in the annulment statute impacted a court's ability to do anything.
Mr. Major, if this court were to agree that the holding in Tutant was correct and that the declaratory judgment was the proper mechanism for a post-mortem voiding of a marriage, are there some issues of fairness that we should be concerned about here? In other words, people don't tend to go into marriages with an eye towards building a case provable in court that the other party is competent. Presumably, they marry and they assume the other is competent. Now that one party is deceased, isn't the other put at a fairly significant disadvantage in terms of proof?
Well, I think it depends on the circumstances, and the facts of this case are admittedly very unique because we do have an individual who was under medical care at the time. She was in a nursing home. She was going to the hospital on a fairly regular basis.
But we all know that nursing home marriages are not that uncommon.
Well, that may be, but in this particular case, this individual's physician had an opinion about whether she was capable of entering into the marriage.
And that opinion was rendered before or after she died?
Before she died.
2 days after the marriage?
I don't know the exact date of when he rendered that opinion.
Okay.
But in terms of fairness, Justice, one of the things that thought about often since this case came up is, I guess, fair to who? And under the circumstances, you have different situations where, in some cases, by way of examples, they're a little extreme. But if a 50-year-old married a 12-year-old, that's not fair to that 12-year-old. And how then would the death of one of those two parties suddenly make this a valid marriage? That gets back, Chief Justice, to your question of what's wrong with the argument, because there are certain circumstances where marriages just simply should not be allowed, and those are examples. Bigamy would be another example where, according to the argument made by the other side, if a bigamist passed away, those marriages become valid because we don't have a choice anymore. We don't have a remedy anymore.
Well, what bothers me is marriage, divorce, annulment of marriages all seem quite statutory to me. And that what you're really asking the court to do is get jurisdiction to act outside of a statute. Because you don't have a statute that says you can declare a marriage void if it is void from the very beginning on the following grounds or on any grounds that make it void. And so how do you overcome my sense of it's statutory and the only statute you have, I mean, I'm not talking about declaratory judgment, which is a general statute that covers everything. The only statute you have says after they die, you can't annul. And annul means make void, right? Whether it's voidable, void. So on what basis does the court act? And maybe you have to challenge my supposition that all of this is statutory.
Chief Justice, that's exactly right. The original power that vested in a court to do this, I think, emanated from the common law. And I think it's been fine-tuned.
Do what? Declare a marriage void?
Correct. And under the circumstances, I think that's where the authority remains. I do think that the question, though, about statutory authority, I think helps our argument from this standpoint. It is clear that annulment is a statutory remedy. On the other hand, voiding a marriage is not. And it's clear, Chapter 765 does not have a procedure set forth that here's what you do. Without question, it isn't there. But it does have requirements as to what is supposed to be what the components are. And it's clear one of the condition precedents, one of the very important conditions precedent to there being a valid marriage is the competence to enter into the marriage. In addition, Chief Justice, under Fuchsgruber, if the legislature did intend to remove the authority of the court under common law to void a marriage posthumously, it had to say so in very, very clear terms.
Why?
I'm sorry?
Why?
Why?
Yeah, why?
Because Fuchsgruber says so.
Well, they have to have a better reason than just it said so. It has to have a better reason than just said so.
Well, I think that the idea is that where there's going to be a deviation from the common law that I think people deserve to know. And I think that there needs to be very clear indication of the legislative intent so that those of us who have to take those laws and then apply them or argue about them know exactly what the reason was, why what was being done was being done.
Is that theory that under our state constitution, the common law continues as it did prior to the enactment of the state constitution? And, I'm not sure, I'm asking, and that then any abrogation of the common law has to be done specifically? Is that what Fuchsgruber says? Or don't you? I'm asking, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question.
That's my recollection of the analysis.
Well, and there's a canon of construction that says when you abrogate the common law,
you have to be
specific,
yeah, that's
which
what
is
I'm talking
a
about.
Very peculiar canon because, after all, the legislature can act.
That's right.
And why force it to do anything?
I think it just emanates from that constitutional provision of carryover of common lawsuits. That's my opinion.
The Fuchsgruber case. It does say at paragraph 25, it is axiomatic that a statute does not abrogate a rule of common law unless the abrogation is clearly expressed and leaves no doubt of the legislature's intent. statutes in derogation of the common law are strictly construed.
What about, what do other states do? I didn't see in your brief much reference to other state law. A couple of cases, but not cited for the real, well, I guess one 1885 case or something again.
Well, Williams is actually a Wisconsin case, but...
No, but you cited a Massachusetts case upon which it relied or something, I think.
The difference usually, one end of the spectrum is that some states look at death as the final end of a marriage and essentially say, how much more over do you want it to be? Somebody has passed away. Other states, like Wisconsin, take the approach that if it's not a valid marriage, you can challenge it after death. So both sides.
Counsel, is there any legislative history that would assist the court in determining why you got 767.313 and then 765.03 and 04? It seemed very contrary to each other. Is there anything that explains that in terms especially of 767.313?
The most recent version of the annulment statute, which is 767.313, the only legislative history is a note that indicates that the word void was removed because there is no such thing as an action affecting the family to void a marriage. And in the definitional section of Chapter 767, either before and after the recodification, there is no such thing as an action affecting the family called voiding a marriage. Beyond that, there is no other explanation as to why the word void was removed. And it's my understanding that the purpose of the recodification was to try to simplify and to reorganize in what was supposed to be a more logical fashion the family code.
What I find interesting is that both 767.313 and 765.04 and 03 seem to have an overlap in terms of reasons given. For instance, the reasons or grounds for annulment seem very similar to what is prohibited in Chapter 765. They're very much parallel, and yet one, the case law seems to say, okay, you can get a declaration of void, null and void, after death. The other one says, no way.
Well, and Justice, I think that's where, when you go back to the Leanne's case, because that's where the court initially set up the interpretation of the annulment statute as a statutory remedy. And so you have limitations on the basis for which a court can grant an annulment, and those are the factors or the grounds enumerated in the statute. On the other hand, I think that under the common law, under Chapter 765, you still have the ability to look at grounds beyond what is set forth in the annulment statute in terms of, do you have a larger universe of facts or circumstances to void a marriage? I think the answer is yes. And I think that's the difference. One is clearly a statutory remedy and is defined in terms of what can a court do with those circumstances. I think the other remains a common law remedy that has a larger universe of circumstances that can be under which it can be utilized.
Thank you.
Now, the sum 2 in 767.313 refers to a null, but 1 also refers to a null. A court may annul a marriage upon any of the following grounds. A party lacked capacity. So it looks like this statute covers all annulment, anything, and that there's nothing else in the statute that authorizes any other proceeding. On the other hand, that means that even if the marriage is void because of lacking capacity to consent, then the parties are stuck if he can't fit under an annulment. And that's what you're balking about.
That's exactly right, Chief Justice.
And 765.03 says a marriage may not be contracted if either party has such want of understanding as renders him incapable. And that's not under annulment. That's under who shall not marry. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Alan Spiegel, representing Joseph McLeod.
May it please the court, my name is Alan Spiegel. To my left and your right is Paul Bugenhagen, and we represent Joseph McLeod. Good afternoon, and thank you for the privilege of standing before you. Before I begin my argument, I believe it's important to clarify a couple of statements that opposing counsel made in his argument. First of all, I think it's important for the court to understand that the temporary guardianship as to Ms. Laubenheimer, my client's wife, was not granted until January 27th of 2009, just days before her death. The parties were married on November 7th, 2008. My listening of the argument left that somewhat in doubt. In addition, opposing counsel referenced the Williams decision, the Lioness decision, and the Davidson decision as justification for the idea that a void marriage can be handled after death. I want to distinguish those three decisions at the outset. First of all, with regard to the Williams decision, at the time of Williams in 1885, the statute read that certain void marriages could be declared absolutely void without any judgment of divorce or other legal proceeding. The statute no longer says that. And I think that should explain to the court why Williams looks different from the cases that came after it.
If there were no court or judicial proceedings, how was it they declared them void then? Did the parties just say, this marriage is void, I'm not married to you anymore, and walk away? What was the mechanism back then?
Williams was unclear as to how that was to work.
Yeah.
I would assume that it would be some sort of a defense to an action or something in that vein. With regard to Lioness and Davidson, both of those cases are annulment cases, and that's an important distinction that we need to make here. They were annulment cases that were brought at a time when the case law drew a distinction between void marriages and voidable marriages, with void marriages having the ability to be challenged after death and voidable not so. That's all before the 1977 statute included the language that said no marriage may be annulled after the death of a party. That's still the statute today.
Are there any exceptions?
In my understanding, no, Your Honor, there are not.
Well, let's go through some of the hypotheticals your opposing counsel
please
posed. Okay, we have a 50-year-old man marrying a 12-year-old young woman. And before any annulment, the 50-year-old man dies. That can't be voided?
I think that when counsel makes that argument, it overlooks some of the safeguards that are put in place under 765 to protect against those situations. Namely, that those parties both have to present at the clerk of court's office with information including a birth certificate, and then that clerk, if that clerk knowingly issues a marriage license for someone who is underage or is part of an illegal marriage, that clerk is subject to criminal penalties. Likewise, to the minister or the court commissioner, as in this case, who marries them, there are penalties there as well.
Okay, how about the bigamist?
The bigamist?
We marry in Michigan, we marry in Iowa, and we marry in Wisconsin.
Well, I think that the most recent case that deals with that exact question, Justice, is the Sinai Samaritan case. And in the Sinai Samaritan case, the Court of Appeals essentially made a ruling directly opposite from what it ruled in Towton, and I think in part puts us in this position, where the one side came in and said, Morgan McCabe came in and said, Gene McCabe's divorce in Mexico wasn't done properly, so our marriage of 28 years was void, and don't don't come calling for the medical expenses from me. The Court of Appeals said there's a footnote 3 that responds directly to the argument the other side's making, that the marriage is void from the outset and that it doesn't need to be annulled. Now, the court said, no, that isn't the case. And it, you know, the quote from the court is, the dispositive statute governing whether Morgan McCabe, who was alleging bigamy, can dispute the validity of his marriage to Jean McCabe is 767.03, which is now 767.313.
Did you ever see the movie Tootsie?
Not. I wasn't expecting that question then.
I can't imagine why.
What's the guy's, the actor's name?
Dustin Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman. He plays a role in Drag. So, let's say we're in Wisconsin, and Gene Smith comes in. And that's the person in Drag. And there is a, the person is married to a male under Wisconsin law. And the one or the other people dies. There's no way to undo that?
Once the marriage has been contracted, so once a minister or a court commissioner has presided over that marriage, once one party dies, that marriage is valid. And I think that one of the cases that cleared that sort of question up in my mind as I was preparing was the Ginkowski case that this court heard in 1965. That's 28 WIS 2D530. In that case, there was a violation of the waiting period after a divorce, and both parties to the case conceded that the marriage was void. However, one party had died, and a 10-year statute of limitations from another part of the law was used as a defense by the wife to say this action should be dismissed, despite the fact that the annulment statute would allow it. And the court said that that statute of limitation, just like statutes of limitation in Wisconsin for all purposes, extinguished the right as well as the remedy. We're here talking about the remedy of annulment, but what we're really talking about is the right to challenge a marriage. So the fact that the legislature in 767.313 says that the right to annul a marriage ends with death, and to annul is to hold void, yes, I believe that the right to void a marriage ends with death, absolutely, under the 767.313. The other response I wanted to provide to your earlier question, Justice, with regard to safeguards to protect against the 50-year-old marrying the 12-year-old or similar circumstances, is we do have this provision for objections to marriage in the event that the 50-year-old picks up the child at school, takes her down to the courthouse, and gets an application. Between the application and the marriage ceremony, a host of relatives have the opportunity to make objections. In this case, Barbara and I had that same opportunity and did not do so. Once the marriage was contracted and the marriage ceremony was performed, the disposition of what we do with marriages shifts to 767. I think one of the places where the legislature gives us an idea that this is their intent is in 767 in... Pardon me. In the action to affirm a marriage statute. And in that statute, it says that any party who questions an existing marriage can bring an action to affirm. And at the end of that hearing on the action to affirm, the court that hears it has two choices. The court can affirm it, or the court can annul it. It doesn't talk about holding a marriage void during someone's life. So what, as some of the questions raised suggested, we have a situation where the other side is asking this court to find that both 765 and 767 can be used in some situations, and the limitations and the interested parties placed on the other side by 767 somehow don't apply if they choose to plead using 765. And that's a big problem from public policy standpoint.
What in 765, which sets forth the civil contract and You need consent of the parties according to 765.01 in the civil contract of marriage. Provides for a marriage being voided. What in 765 kicks you into 767?
Well, I don't know that 765 has any reference to 767. However, the statute we're talking about, 767.313, does have a reference back to 765. In sub 1, sub D, it notes that an annulment is proper if the marriage is prohibited by the laws of this state, and in the last line of that that clause is the impediment has not been removed under 765.24. So it isn't as if the legislature has two bodies of law that don't correspond with each other. The language of the titles, you know, who may contract for a marriage. Pardon me. Validity of marriages abroad, those are all issues that are dealt with at the time of the marriage ceremony. Once the ceremony is performed, we flip over to 767 by virtue of the fact that it becomes an action affecting the family.
Well, I'm not convinced. You have to convince me. Your reference to 767.24 is to a statute that, you know, if you're married, husband in World War II, goes off to war, you think he's dead, he's not dead, he's a prisoner in war, you remarry in good faith. I mean, that's the kind of situation that's set forth in 765.24 that's referenced in 767.313.1D. So that reference to that statute doesn't compel me. I mean, I see 765.01 as a civil contract, and parties have to be capable of, in the law of contracting, and that's essential to that civil contract of marriage. It says in 765.21 talks about marriages in violation of certain provisions shall be void. You know, you didn't anticipate the Tootsie question. How about Article 1, Section 9? And that provides that for every right, there's a remedy. Well, it looks to me like 765.21 gives a right to void a marriage. Doesn't have limitations with regard to death. So why isn't there a remedy available? It's kind of a follow-up in some ways of Justice, a different way of Justice Rogensack's questions, which focused on in 765 there was a procedure, and years ago they voided marriage. They had to have something to implement it. But anyway, Article 1, Section 9, what do you think about that?
I think in this case that is where the Court of Appeals diverged between the Sinai Samaritan case and the Towton case. In Sinai Samaritan, you had a claim that a marriage was void under 765 because the statutory waiting period had not expired. Sinai Samaritan came back in when Mr. McCabe came back in and sought to have that marriage voided under 765. And the Court of Appeals, which obviously is not binding on this court, but in an analysis that we would ask this court to adopt, told Mr. McCabe that he was out of luck because the annulment statute is the remedy to void, to end void or voidable marriages, and that remedy ends at a person's death.
That, in some ways, begs the question of whether or not there's a separate right under 765 or there is only a right that if there's a separate remedy that can be available in enforcing a right under 765, or if the only remedy available for enforcing 765 right is 767.
Right, and that goes back to that Ginkowski holding, Justice, where I think this court has been clear in the past that when a statute extinguishes a remedy, it extinguishes the right that underlies that remedy. The remedy here is annulment, and that both sides agree that that right was extinguished at Nancy Laubenheimer's death. The right was to challenge a void marriage, and these annulment statutes, statute of limitations on that, also extinguished the right to challenge the marriage.
Yeah, that's true if you follow your line of reasoning. Not necessarily true if you don't. You've got 767, what is it, 313, dealing with annulment?
Yep.
All right. And you can argue that if you want to do anything about a party lacking capacity and you want to annul, a court may annul it on those grounds, and you can only bring an annulment before somebody, one of the parties' death. You have 765.03, who shall not marry? And it says a marriage may not be contracted, and the use of the negative may not means shall. It is obligatory that a marriage that is attempted, if either party has a want of understanding, is not a valid marriage contract, right? I mean, that's what it says.
It says that parties may not contract. Yes, I agree with that.
Okay. No cross-reference to 767.313, right?
Correct.
A different chapter, right?
Undoubtedly.
Okay. So what can be drawn from that is, okay, you got two choices. If you want to annul, then you have to use 767.313 and follow that. But it's an absolute invalid under the statutes marriage if there's no competency on the part of one of the parties. And you can draw from that it has to have another remedy. Now, I'm, with all due deference and respect to Justice Crooks and Justice Bradley, I'm not necessarily willing to go to the Wisconsin Constitution, to Article 1, Section 9, and deal with that. Too complicated. It just seems to me the intent here is this is an invalid marriage, and the court has to declare it invalid. And that you don't have to go to the other statute, which is deals with annulment. It's a separate, different statute. And that a court in this state has subject matter jurisdiction over any proceeding involving people. The court said that all the time. That's what the circuit court does have. And therefore, and there's nothing in this 765.03 that takes away the court's competence.
There,
the court can do it.
Pardon me. No,
I'm done.
I disagree with you on two grounds.
Okay, good.
First of all, I think the legislature gives us an idea of their intent in creating Section 765 through 768 when they lay out their intent section in 765.001. And they talk about the promoting the stability and best interests of the family,
right,
and stability of marriage as being basic to morality.
Right, but it's not moral if a person can't really contract for a marriage, and you don't have a very good family basis if one of the people is incompetent. So I don't have any problem with that. Why was looking at, give me your second one, then I'm going to ask you this. Why was this annulment provision? What was the public policy behind it? What was the purpose behind it? Then I'm going to say, does this marriage fall within that? So go ahead. You give me your second reason.
The second one goes back to the Lyoness case, or Lyoness, or however we pronounce it. And that case, and it was cited by Falk for this very purpose, made clear that annulment is the proper procedure for setting aside both void and voidable marriages. Now, at the time of Falk and at the time of Lyoness, There was a companion to chapter. There was a predecessor to chapter 765 that had many of these same provisions. So it has been this court's practice, from Lyoness forward, that we use an annulment to take care of a void or voidable marriage. Outside of Towton, there isn't a case out there that says we can do it another way. And Linus also, in as cited in Davidson, also said that you can't make an action for rescission of a marriage based on fraud, the reason being the powers of this court to dissolve marriage are statutory and not equitable. The other side acknowledged in their argument that this wasn't a statutory remedy that they're seeking. This is an equitable one. The Linus Court dealt with that in 1920. So that bridge has been crossed.
May I ask, if you have a married couple, they're both alive, are there any instances in which one of the parties tries to void the marriage without annulling the marriage?
I don't believe so. And the reason is the annulment statute gives the court power to do things like distributing property, awarding support, or to not do those things. So the annulment statute encompasses of a lot of authority for the trial court to make decisions in the best interest of the folks before them.
So that if we went to circuit courts all over Wisconsin, we would find no cases to void marriages. They'd all be annulments.
If they're following the law under Section 767.313, that is what you would find, Justice. Now, before I forget, I want to get back to the question you asked me.
Did you forget? What was the purpose of this annulment statute?
All right. The purpose of the annulment statute is some of the public policy issues that the court was questioning Attorney Major on earlier. For example, if two parties were to leave the state and violate this 6 months waiting period, so they go down to Illinois or Iowa where they don't have this period, go get married in return, which is a clear violation of 765 and renders the marriage void under 765. One of the party's children could hold on to that information until the first party died. If the first party to die was their parent, they could say, oh, the marriage was void, I want all dad's stuff back. If the first party to die was the other party to the marriage, the child could keep that information buried, eventually getting the property belonging to the other party to the marriage. The other reason, to be frank, I think was best enunciated by Judge Gonnering in his opinion on this matter at the trial court. And he talked about the evidentiary concerns and the public policy concerns that would be raised by this. With regard to evidentiary concerns, we'd have the dead man statute issues surrounding that. We'd have hearsay rules and inevitable issues on what evidence was relevant at that time. Certainly, Mr. McLeod would be at a disadvantage at such a hearing because he didn't have an opportunity to have Ms. Laubenheimer examined prior to her death. But in addition, it's a clear reality that people who are at one point incompetent can't regain their competence. And if Ms. Laubenheimer was deemed to be incompetent at the time of the marriage, there's nothing to say that she couldn't have regained her competence during the 3 months between the marriage and her death and subsequently remarried if the issue had been raised during her life.
But if she hadn't remarried, she can't fix that. I mean, if she hadn't remarried, she couldn't fix it if she was incompetent at the original contract.
Correct.
Okay. Yes. You agree with that?
Yes, I'm not suggesting there's a remedy under 765, but she could certainly recontract.
When I was in practice, if we had a person who was about to make a will and either was very elderly or there was some other issues that made one think that the will might be challenged on the ground of incompetency, the firm made a record about competence, might have talked to the with the client's permission, talked to the doctor, had they had the doctor examine him within the week of signing the will, might have had to be sure that the witnesses knew the person very well, so that you take precautions when you know there may be a problem, and that would have been true if we had people in the nursing home or any other institution who wanted to get married. Would have said, hey, we've got a problem here.
That's certainly, that is,
right?
Pardon me. That is certainly good practice.
And the other thing about it, you know, if you have a marriage, as in one of the cases where it lasts for 20 years and you have to go back 20 years ago and see what the scene was then, you may have all these evidentiary problems. But you don't have them in this case.
Well, I disagree with that, Madam Chief Justice. Because the star witness of the case, Nancy Laubenheimer, isn't available to be examined or to testify if she wishes.
He's there. He can testify. There were people in the nursing home who could testify. There were doctors who could testify. And they may be subject to cross-examination, which is the great engine of truth. And so you've got everybody is still there. I mean, because this is a very short time period.
Pardon me.
Did they do an autopsy? Do they know what her cause of death was? Do they know exactly what?
I don't know that information.
I mean, okay.
With regard to your question, Madam Chief Justice, that is certainly, you've explained what would be good practice in these situations.
Mm-hmm.
And you've explained potential ways that it could be averted. I want to call your attention to two things. First of all, Mr. McLeod, who goes by Clark, and Nancy were married before a court commissioner in Washington County. So it's not as if these folks were married in front of someone they found on the Internet or someone of less repute. Commissioner Jeff Jager oversaw this marriage. And
he could testify.
He certainly could. Now, as to the testimony of my client or Commissioner Jager, we then run right back into those issues of dead man statute and hearsay. Are we going to be able to talk about what Nancy said, what her condition was, what she told her doctor? And if we can't, all we're left with is an opinion from the other side's expert and stricken testimony on our side. And that's another inequity of this situation. The other point that I wanted to make is that the other side in this case is maintaining a civil action for interference with inheritance. So it's not as if this is the only avenue. The state of Wisconsin has an interest in solidifying marriages at the time of the first party's death. That does not prevent them, despite the fact that I have asked the judge to prevent them, it does not prevent them from going forward with a civil action to show that they have been damaged by what they believed is improper conduct by Mr. McLeod.
Fact situation in terms of second marriage and will not updated so that your deceased husband is still your beneficiary and then the kids are beneficiaries, the same kind of situation you have here. But let's change it just a little bit so that it's, you know, Uncle Will, and Uncle Will is 92 and lonely, and so he goes on the Internet and brings in a bride from Estonia. Right? Now, that happens with greater frequency than some of us realize. Maybe it just happens in Marathon County, but I'll tell you it happens. And so you have the same fact situation here. You know, there's the kind of evidence that you'd have and not have, and the marriage, and then it's quickly. Uncle Will dies. Is there no recourse of the beneficiaries in having that, the opportunity, depends on the facts of the case, but having the right to have that marriage declared void and therefore not subject to the spousal share?
Well, in cases similar to that, you see claims like unjust enrichment and things like that for parties that they believe that they have cared for a relative or contributed to that relative's care.
I know those, but that's not the genre I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of, you know, kind of a fly-by-day arrangement here. You know, something quick and it just didn't last long and the mental capacity is questioned. That's the kind of fact situation I'm trying to put up as a hypothetical for you to respond to.
Sure. Well, there was the situation prior to 1977 where those sort of things could be challenged after the death of a party. And in the 1977 revision of the statutes, the legislature came back and said, nope, annulments end at a party's death. Because what the legislature is, pardon me?
Please finish.
What the legislature is weighing is the concerns over issues like that and concerns about you leaving 765 open, whereas in this case, as the other side has acknowledged in their reply brief, there is no guidance as to who is an interested party, and there's no guidance as to what the limit is on challenging these.
My concern is that your answer seems to beg the question. Your answer, the essence of your answer, was there's no annulment allowed after death. The nuance to that is, do you have to bring an annulment in order to void a marriage? Is there a separate avenue of voiding a marriage under 765? So that's, you know, so it isn't that an annulment isn't allowed after death. I take that as correct because that's what the statute says.
Well, what you're asking is essentially the same evaluation the Towton Court went through and the Sinai Samaritan Court went through in evaluating these things. And our answer to that is it comes down to this holding from Lioness that's repeated in Davidson, that's repeated in Falk, that annulment is the proper remedy to set aside void and voidable marriages. So before 1977, there was a distinction as to the term of days that you could file that annulment. With the change in 77, we have annulment as the only remedy, and it limited to the death of the first party.
No. John? So suppose that there is an annulment. There is an annulment proceeding after the marriage brought by the guardian of the woman, and then she dies before the judgment is entered. Of course, you know, you get 20 days to answer, and then you got briefing, and, you know, this annulment could last, proceeding could last a year or more, right?
Indeed.
But it says here, a judicial proceeding is required to annul marriage. A marriage may not be annulled after the death of the party. So if there had been an annulment brought, but she died before judgment, the end.
Correct, and that's the holding of this court in the Davidson case.
That is a very, very stringent requirement.
Well, I think it's a stringent requirement based on protecting the interests of marriage in this state.
But based on competence of the parties. I mean, that's where you get into the circle.
Sure. And if I may briefly respond, I know I'm out of time.
You may.
I'll go back to the safeguards that 765 has in place, where parties who wish to be married go in and meet with a clerk and file an application, and then are married in front of a minister who is who could be criminally penalized if he marries people that do not meet the standards of 765.
That would go for a judge who performs a marriage, too.
Pardon me?
That would go for a judge who performs a marriage, too, also?
I believe so, yes. I can, the citation
I'll
is...
I'll change all my procedures from now on. Thank you, Cal.
Could I ask one?
Yes, sorry, Justice Prosser.
There was a pretty big election in 2008, just about the time of the marriage. Did the bride vote?
I don't know that, to be honest with you. I know that, as I mentioned, she was not under a temporary guardianship for multiple months after the marriage, but I don't know whether she voted or not.
And was there another witness beside? Who were the witnesses?
To the marriage?
Yeah.
The court commissioner, Jeff Jaeger, and I believe two clerks from the county. My client and Nancy did not bring any witnesses with them.
Did anyone else in the family know about the marriage?
I don't believe... Are you speaking in Nancy's family?
Yeah.
And we're getting into the delicacies of family relationships, but I don't believe that Nancy chose to notify her family that the marriage was happening. Thank you all.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Baker.
One of the implications of my friend's argument is that there is no such thing as a void marriage anymore. And we know that that is not true because the statute very clearly says that there are void marriages. the idea that Toutant itself does not seem to, does not carry the weight because we have this Sinai Samaritan case, does not, in fact, prove to be the case, because Toutant did address Sinai Samaritan and said that that was not an applicable case to these circumstances because it involved an annulment. And this is what the Toutant case says about Sinai Samaritan in paragraph 22. Principal cases cited by Ellis, Davidson, and Sinai Samaritan are in apposite. Sinai Samaritan involved a creditor's action against a surviving husband for medical bills incurred by his deceased spouse. Sinai Samaritan was a marital property case. We have before us an estate case involving a declaratory judgment as to how the assets of the estate should be distributed. The principles set forth in Sinai Samaritan are inapplicable. In addition, the idea that there are safeguards in place because there are witnesses. This marriage took place basically in secret. The family was not told that this was happening. This was an individual who was taking this woman out of nursing home against medical advice, oftentimes disappearing with her, and she would end up in the hospital. One of the reasons Judge Farragher did not make him a temporary guardian is that Judge Farragher found that this individual, Mr. McLeod, would not follow the medical advice. This is not a situation where we have two individuals who have essentially, one of the individuals to the relationship has cut out the family members for various reasons, and that is the reason why they didn't know what was going on. This was a situation where an individual took a woman out of a nursing home multiple times, brought her back in worse condition than she left, and under the circumstances, nobody other than the three people who were at the wedding ceremony knew anything about the wedding. So these safeguards that are in place statutorily. We would all like to believe that statute.
Don't you have two witnesses to a marriage? Yeah. Most of the weddings I do, there's the bride and groom signs, and then I always have two witnesses signed. Weren't there two witnesses at this marriage?
Yes, that is the case, but nobody in the family. Nobody. No friends came to the wedding, no family members.
Who were the witnesses?
I believe the witnesses were the clerks at the courthouse.
Is the marriage license in the record?
I believe it is.
Okay. If it's there, we'll find it. Thank you.
Nancy went to the courthouse not only to be married, but to pick up a marriage license?
I don't think that's the case, but I don't know for sure.
Was this in?
I'm sorry?
What county was
Washington County.
Washington. Many counties, when we get the marriage certificate, it's already been signed by the man and woman. I'm just telling you, before the wedding.
Some of the additional arguments with regard to the application of case law, I think, are not necessarily correct. For example, the argument that the Leanne's case establishes that the only remedy is annulment to void or voidable marriage. Again, in the Witt case, said what this court decided in the Leanne's case was that the legislature, having by statute specified the grounds upon which Wisconsin courts might annul marriages, such a legislative action was intended to be exclusive in character, thus negativing the right of the circuit court sitting as a court of equity to grant annulments on additional grounds not specified by statute. In addition, Leanne's itself sets forth the following. In the void marriage, the relationship of the party, so far as it's being legal concerned, is concerned, is an absolute nullity from its very beginning and cannot be ratified. It may be questioned at any time during the life of both, and with some statutory exceptions, after the death of either or both, and generally whether the question arises directly or collaterally. So Leanne's does not establish that a void marriage cannot be challenged after death. In fact, it says quite the opposite.
Counselor, if you prevail, it goes back for a fact-finding. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. On competence.
Correct. Now, in addition, with regard to Davidson, Davidson also does not establish that your only option is annulment if you have a void or voidable marriage. It says, a resolution of this controversy requires a determination of whether the marriage was void or voidable. If the marriage was voidable, it was valid and in effect at the time of Leona's death, and the personal cause of action for annulment abated at the time of her death. That's what my friend argued. On the other hand, it goes on. If the marriage was void during its entirety, the cause of action survives in her estate, and the court could retain jurisdiction to declare the marriage void and restore her property to the estate. So the arguments of the other side that these cases establish that annulment is the only option, that's simply not the case. Or, and again, I repeat, we're not asking the court to annul anything. We're asking the court to declare the marriage void.
The circuit court, not this court.
Correct. Now, with regard to the evidentiary questions and concerns, the complaint seems to be that the evidence doesn't favor them. Well, that happens in cases sometimes. Sometimes you have a bad case that does not strip a court of authority that it has. I think my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. In fact, I want to thank both counsels for their arguments and briefs in this case. We usually have divorce cases with the recognition of the validity of marriage, so it's unusual for the court to have a case challenging the validity of the marriage. And that concludes our hearing on 11AP, 1176, and 1177, McLeod versus Mudlaff and Mudlaff versus McLeod. The court will convene in a closed conference at 3:30. We are in recess on oral arguments until later this month when we have 2 more days of oral arguments.